Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, the 30th of December, 1999. We're in the Fireside Room this afternoon for a forum on School of the Americas Protests 1999. Session number is FO99-20. Let's listen in.
I'm Brent. I serve the village here as the computer support person and some other stuff. This fall, a number of us, well, I went down from the community and met a number of former community members in Fort Benning, Georgia, to protest the School of Americas. And I guess this forum is kind of intended to be an introduction as to the School of Americas and what we did there, and also a kind of reflection on what it means to actively put yourself on the line for nonviolence and to be nonviolently active in the face of oppression. So we're going to watch a video, and then those of us that were there will talk briefly about what we did and how that felt. And then I'd like to open it up to other people's reactions and experience and try to engage in conversation to figure out what it means to act nonviolently.
It was like 15 minutes, right?
Yeah, the video is 14 minutes long. Janet, can you get the lights on?
U.S. Ambassador, it revealed the bodies of four women. Mary Knoll's sisters, Maura Clark and Edith Ford. Ursuline's sister, Dorothy Cazell. And lay missionary, Jean Donovan. Of the five officers later found responsible for the rape and murder of these women, three were graduates of the United States Army School of the Americas. According to the Pentagon, the mission of the school is to train the armed forces of Latin America, promote military professionalism, foster cooperation among multinational military forces, and to expand the trainees' knowledge of United States customs and traditions. The School of the Americas originated in 1946 in Panama. Now it is located on the grounds of Fort Benning, Georgia. The school teaches commando operations, sniper training, how to fire an M16, and psychological warfare. Since no major declared war between Latin American countries has occurred in decades, and the communist threat has vanished, why provide this kind of training? Representative Joseph Kennedy.
If you look at the course ranges that are offered to these individuals, they in fact are a dedicated way of teaching military leaders in foreign nations how to subvert their local communities.
Since it opened, over 55,000 military officials from 23 Latin American and Caribbean countries have trained at the school. About 2,000 students a year. As facts have emerged about the school and its graduates, it has drawn the attention of a growing number of human rights activists, such as Mary Knoll Father Roy Bourgeois.
Just down the road here is the School of the Americas. It's a combat school. Most of the courses revolve around what they call counterinsurgency warfare. Who are the insurgents? We have to ask that question. They are the poor. They are the people in Latin America who call for reform. They are the landless peasants who are hungry. They are healthcare workers, human rights advocates, labor organizers. They become the insurgents. They are seen as el enemigo, the enemy. And they are those who become the targets of those who learn their lessons at the School of the Americas.
What has been learned about the lessons taught at the school? In the 1980s, the Civil War in El Salvador became a focal point for human rights activists throughout the world. Death squads operated freely, often killing 50 people a minute. There were so many cases that on March 23, 1980, Archbishop Oscar Romero in San Salvador made a plea to the military leaders of his country.
I would like to make an appeal in a special way to the men of the army. In the name of God, in the name of the suffering people, whose immense rise to the heaven each day more tumultuous, I beg you, I ask you, I order you, in the name of God, stop the repression.
While celebrating Mass the next day, Archbishop Romero was assassinated. A number of years later, the National Security Archives in Washington, D.C. made an important discovery when they obtained a copy of a declassified cable. Kate Doyle.
These two cables are both from the American Embassy in El Salvador. One is from Dean Hinton, who's been ambassador to El Salvador in 1981. And it discusses a meeting during which Roberto Villazón plans the murder of Archbishop Romero. During the meeting, there is described a lottery that the people who are attending the meeting hold to see who would draw the right to kill Romero himself.
Villazón was trained at the School of the Americas. Also trained at the school were two of the three officers directly responsible for the assassination. December 11, 1981, El Mozote, a small village in El Salvador.
First, they forced everyone out of their houses and made us all lie face down in the street, both men and women. There were soldiers on both sides. Then they moved away to see the women kneeling down on the ground to pray. They killed all of them. Not a single one of them survived. Just me, by the grace of God. I hid under a tree. When I heard the screams of the children, and I knew which ones were mine, they were crying, "Mommy, they're killing us."
Over 900 men, women, and children were massacred. Virtually the entire population of the village and the area surrounding El Mozote. Out of 143 bodies identified in the laboratory, 131 were of children under the age of 12, including three infants under the age of 3 months. 10 of the 12 officers cited as responsible for the El Mozote massacre were graduates of the School of the Americas. They were members of the Atlacato Battalion, a part of the El Salvador Army. November 16, 1989. San Salvador. Six Jesuit priests, their housekeeper, and her 15-year-old daughter were slaughtered. To get the facts about this incident, a U.S. congressional investigation began, led by Representative Joseph Mocha.
I went down, talked with the embassy, talked with the military, talked with the unionists. I had planned to find meetings set up in very dingy places to talk to people that didn't want to talk to me in public. We gathered enough information that we pushed the investigation to the degree that it was concluded and the people were found guilty that perpetrated the crime. the killing was done by the Africa Tal Battalion, which is the crack battalion in that country. And these are the people, some of them had just returned from the United States, where they were taught, of course, on human rights, amongst other things.
19 of the 26 officers implicated in the Jesuit murders were graduates of the school, including Yushi Rene Mendoza, the lieutenant in charge of the squad that killed the Jesuits and the two men. He attended a commando course a year before the massacre took place.
The Truth Commission of the UN substantiated everything that I had brought forward.
The United Nations Truth Commission report, released on March 15, 1993, cited specific officers for committing atrocities during the El Salvador Civil War. At School of the Americas Watch, just outside Fort Benning, Georgia, Vicki Immerman matched the names cited in the UN report with names in the United States government document.
What I did was I took these officers, all the officers listed in the report, and I took their names and looked them up in this list of graduates of the School of the Americas, which we received through the Freedom of Information Act. What I found were 49 of the 60-some officers listed were graduates of the School of the Americas. These officers attended the school both before and after they committed atrocities. Francisco Dasgid, right here, was on the commandant's list a couple years after he ordered the massacre of about 16 civilians and had their corpses burned.
El Salvador is only part of the school's story. In the entry area of one of its main buildings are photographs of those the school honored, its so-called Hall of Fame. At the top of the list, Hugo Banzer, former dictator of Bolivia, a graduate of the school. Some of the others similarly honored are the former dictators of Honduras, Ecuador, and Argentina, and generals from eight other Latin and Caribbean nations, many cited by human rights groups for involvement in human rights abuses in their own country. Among other graduates, Manuel Noriega, former president of Panama, currently in prison in the United States. Four of the five ranking Honduran officers who organized death squads in the 1980s as part of Battalion 316 are graduates. Half of the 250 Colombian officers cited for human rights abuses attended the school. The three highest-ranking Peruvian officers convicted in February 1994 of murdering nine university students and a professor were all graduates. Also, the Peruvian army commander who brought out tanks to obstruct initial investigation of the murders. During the dictatorship of the Somoza family, over 4,000 National Guard troops graduated from the school. Many of them later became known as the Contras, responsible for the deaths of thousands of Nicaraguan peasants in the 1980s. The general in charge of Argentina's so-called Dirty War was a school graduate. During that internal conflict in the late 1970s and early 1980s, an estimated 30,000 people were tortured, disappeared, and murdered. General Hector Gramajo of Guatemala was the featured speaker at the school's graduation ceremonies in 1991. Human rights groups claim he is the architect of strategies that legalized military atrocities in Guatemala, resulting in the death of over 200,000 men, women, and children.
As a Catholic priest, as a U.S. citizen, I really feel a responsibility to speak out against that because of this. This does not lead to healing. It leads to death itself. In a way, this is a death machine. And this, I want to say, is very close to home because it's in our backyard. It's not out there in El Salvador. This is not in South Africa. We're talking about a school of assassins right here in our backyard being supported and financed through our tax money. It's being done in our name.
$30 million of U.S. taxpayer money was recently spent to renovate school headquarters and these housing units for soldiers attending the school.
It's an outrage. It's the use of our tax dollars, American tax dollars, for what I think your average American feels is a distinctly un-American purpose.
An amendment offered.
On September 30th, 1993, the School of the Americas was debated by Congress for the first time in its history. It happened when an amendment to the Defense Department budget was introduced by Congressman Joseph Kennedy.
Mr. Speaker, my amendment would reduce the Army operation and maintenance account by $2.9 million, the amount dedicated to running the Army School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia. The intent of this amendment is to close the school.
Why should we continue to fund and condone military and spy murder? Why should we continue to train thugs to kill their own people? Vote for peace. Vote for nonviolence. Vote for harmony. Vote for the Kennedy Amendment.
174 voted in favor, 256 against.
We're only 30 or 40 votes short of winning. That means that if people around the country hear about this and write their congressmen, we can win. This is an issue that we can win.
What's very important right now, I feel, is to let all the voices be heard. Bishop O'Merrill said it best before he was killed, before he was assassinated by someone who trained at the School of the Americas. He said, we who have a voice, we have to speak for the voices. And I realize that we here in this country, we have a voice. We can speak without having to worry about being disappeared or tortured or being picked up. We can speak. And I just hope that we can speak fairly and boldly on this issue.
In April 1994, a group of human rights activists from around the country began a 40-day fast on the steps of the U.S. Capitol. They were there to make their case for shutting down the School of the Americas. The day before the fast ended, Congressman Kennedy joined them in a press conference.
The so-called Hall of Faith in Georgia is nothing more than a hall of shame for the people of our country. We know that we as a nation and as a people have a right and an obligation to say what we believe in terms of how our dollars are going to be spent. And what we are saying unequivocally is that we do not want to be associated with the kinds of individuals that are torturing, killing, and maiming innocent people throughout Latin America. That's what this bill is all about, and that's what your commitment is all about. And we commit to working until this bill is passed.
The next day, Congressman Kennedy's second effort to shut the school was defeated by a smaller margin than his first try. 175 voted for his amendment, 217 against.
I'm not very educated, but in my simple words, I think that the only thing the School of the Americas has accomplished is the destruction of our countries in Latin America. Don't give us any more of that military aid. It would be better to help the poor who are in need.
We need the voices of others, and we also need those letters to congressional leaders to let them know that we will not allow them to use our money to run a school of assassins.
I'd like to introduce Peter Thompson, who's a member of the Holden Board, and he's going to kind of run through an update as to what's happened since this was made in 1995.
The most dramatic event probably in the last few years has been this year in Congress,
a majority of the representatives in the House of Representatives sponsored the bill to withdraw funding from the School of the Americas, and not surprisingly, it passed the House. And it went to conference committee where it was defeated by one vote. So the Senate has not yet come online, but the House has, and every expectation is the House will do the same this session. There'll be a large action in Washington, D.C. in May to try and lobby and otherwise mobilize support to cut the funding. The Army has redoubled their PR efforts and their lobbying and flying people to Georgia and renaming the School of the Americas this last fall, the day before the protests, and lots of other things to try and stave off the what I view is probably the inevitable right now. Because the grassroots movement has grown to such an extent that people really know what the School of the Americas is now and what it's done, and there's really a tremendous consciousness among people to, you know, put an end to that this particular institution. A few years ago, I didn't really think that, but now it's pretty apparent to me that it's going to be accomplished with the good work of people like yourselves. And I thought that it was particularly appropriate that we would talk about this issue this week during the peace conference that's being led by Jerry and others here, because this is a real tangible project. It really started with Father Bourgeois, and I had the privilege of meeting him when he was finishing a prison term in Minnesota and then starting to represent him, and I've been his lawyer and the lawyer for the protesters for the last 9 years. And I've really been able to see a movement that really can start from one man's commitment. And he was really all alone when it started. I mean, the first time there was only Father Bourgeois was the only person. And he served more time in prison himself than all of the assassins and perpetrators of the murders you just heard about have served in Latin America. And so it's out of his commitment, and he feels that lots of times he's doing education and outreach. He's traveling around the country, he's doing presentations on the School of the Americas. First thing he had to do was convince Marinoles, the order of the priests, because they didn't like what he was doing. He'd been in Bolivia for 4 years and worked with the poor there when Hugo Banzer was the dictator, and he got into all sorts of trouble down there. Then he began to learn about El Salvador, and he went to El Salvador. Everyone thought he was killed when he was down in El Salvador, and he came back with what he'd found there. And then he started doing actions of civil disobedience, education actions, and then when he gets done doing education for a certain period of time and feels the momentum is really slacking, he says, the only way I can get more credibility is put my body on the line. And that's when he'll, you know, do something that'll end up getting him in prison. And so I think this is a wonderful example of what can happen. He started in 1983, so it's taken him 16 years to get to the point where he's getting near success. And a lot of it's been very lonely and very hard struggle and subject to a lot of criticism and ridicule. And I'll never forget, I was down in the Tallahassee Federal Prison visiting him before I argued a case in the 11th Circuit for him. And I'd only known him for a few years. He was serving a 16-month term, and he was down there, you know, it's 95 degrees and 95% humidity every day, and he's packed in there like sardines, and he had a few months left, and his spirits were high. And I said, well, Roy, what are you going to do when you get out? And he said, I'm going back to the apartment. When he saw the School of America's watch officer, he has a little apartment right on the, at the front gate. He says, I'm going to go back there, and I'm going to close the school. And I said, Roy, you're crazy. I said, there's lots of things to do. The Army's too big. You're never going to get this done. You're going to die doing this. And there's lots of things you can do, and you're very charismatic, and you can do a lot of good, you're going to end up spending the rest of your life butting your head against the wall, never getting it done. And he said, that may be right. He says, but it's what I have to do. And so he went back there, and about 2 years ago, I was going to hang on with him no matter what, because I believed in him, and I believed that the institution was an evil one and one that should be resisted. But about 2 years ago, all of a sudden, all of the college kids showed up. And that was the time when I believed. Before then, you know, I was a young person in that movement. Everyone down there had white hair. It was all the, you know, radical Catholic wing that had resisted Vietnam, and all of a sudden all the college kids started coming a couple years ago, and then it was apparent to me that it was going to happen because he had a much broader appeal. So it's been a real interesting phenomena to watch how this social action has really built, and now it's much, much bigger than one person. And this fall we had, they estimated 12,000 people down there, and 5,000 people chose to go over the line. That is risk arrest for civil disobedience. So what I thought could be real valuable for this week is we have here four people who went over the line. I did not go over the line.
One sick.
There were six, like, from a Holden group went over the line.
And one just left. All six were up here a few days ago, but Katrina left.
Katrina left. And we have four here, and Kate is in bed sick, but five of the six are here. And I had just real pride in watching them walk over the line together, arm in arm. And I thought, you know, in terms of the trainings that are being done this week and how you take an idea into personal action and decide what you should do. And this is not to say that doing civil disobedience is what you have to do to be committed or to live out your faith. And for many people, it's not the right thing to do. Some people, it is the right thing to do. But I thought it could be interesting for the four people here to personally share what they thought about to go down, what they thought about and whether they were going to do it or not, and then what it was like, the experience, and particularly if it was a feeling of their spiritual journey or they got some insights into faith considerations and just some of the practical things that come up in people's life when you decide, you know, you are going to risk arrest, because all four came from a different place. And so Mary Beth and Kata and Saul and Brent were four of the six from Holden that
did Sparky go over the line too?
Yeah. So I met someone from Holden on the other side of the line.
Ricky,
I don't remember.
Oh, it's Ricky. So, this was the six that were hanging out right with us. Oh, that's Ricky. So, I think, you know, we don't have too much time. We could answer questions about the School of America and all that, and I'd be glad to do that, but, and have these people do it too, but maybe before we get to that, we could kind of go through Mary Beth, Ricky, and Saul, and Brent.
I'm really glad that Peter asked us to say something, because going through this, I kind of let it sit on the back burner afterwards. It was a pretty emotional weekend, and then it's really been good for me to think about it today and actually figure out how I want to verbalize why I went. I went because I didn't really know that much about the school until last summer when Jack Nelson Pallmeyer was here and gave a presentation. And I still couldn't rattle off all the facts about it for you, but I know enough about it that and talked to enough people that I knew that it was incredibly wrong and that it was the least I could do to go to Georgia, somewhere in my own country, and protest the school. And I was pretty confident that I would cross the line before I left the Philadelphia area. But it wasn't until I got there and made sure I met up with all these guys and felt really comfortable. I was so happy to be with Holden folks and people that I loved and felt comfortable with. And that made a big difference. And you know, automatically was like, this is something that I can do, that, you know, it doesn't feel like that much to just walk somewhere, but the people who couldn't take that action for whatever reason were incredibly grateful that we could do that. And for me, the most important thing about going was solidarity, because, you know, a movement isn't really anything, even if there's a lot of people that care about the issue, unless they're together and unless they can show that they're united. And so it was about being in solidarity with Central and South Americans who had experienced this violence in their own lives, and with priests and nuns whose brothers and sisters had been killed, helping people. And also in solidarity with students and American citizens like myself who don't want to live in a world or raise children in a world that has this kind of violence going on, or really any kind of violence. So that's why I went. And it's also really exciting to be there and be meeting all these other people who are interested in the same cause, especially when this is a crucial time for that school. And it's hopefully clear that in the near future it will. So.
I wasn't going to say anything because I wasn't sure I crossed for the right reasons. I think I crossed because I'm a mom. When Roy disappeared in El Salvador, Kata was, three, and we were living in Chicago. And they had a vigil for him because they thought he'd been killed. And so we went downtown, and she rode on my shoulders, and it was her first protest. And I'm not real politically out there. You know, usually I go to protests and stuff, but that's, you know. And she had gotten arrested. She had crossed the line last year, or 2 years ago. And so she was risking a second time, which is a lot more serious than the first time. The people crossed, the risk wasn't as high this year as it has been in previous years. They didn't think that they were going to do the arrests. So, but you never know what the mother is going to do. So, this year I saw she was going across, and she was going across with Mary Beth and Saul and Katrina and Brent, and the people that I love. And I didn't want her to go alone. And so I went, and it was, and I've known a lot of other people that crossed the line that I know and care about, but this particular group was just real special to me. I just sort of decided at the last minute. I mean, I'd been down there, you know, another time, and had been with it from the beginning, but it was just that I saw them going, and I didn't want to stay behind. I wanted to go. And we all, it was just so, it was, we all just kind of, we walked mm-hmm. like this. Mm-hmm. And so you can talk about the peace grants because that was so special. But everybody holds a white cross and it has the name of someone who's been killed. And 5,000, was it 5,000 or 6,000 cross? And everyone held the cross, and then someone up front would call out the name, like, Francisca Chevrolet, 14 years. And then everybody went, presente. And a 6,000 people crossed the line. The other, how many thousand?
6,000.
Were silent. Everyone was silent while everyone crossed the line. And it was an incredibly moving thing for everyone. So.
Yeah, for me, it was something I've known about the School of the Americas for a while. I really wanted to go down the year before this year as well, but I was up here and couldn't make the trip, and had the opportunity this year, and made it down there, and it was amazingly powerful for me to cross with people that I love and respect, you know, from living with and being with. And just the fact that, I mean, as you do cross, they, you know, it took like 2 hours for us to cross, I think all of us. And they never ran out of names to call. Mm. They never stopped saying somebody. And it's just, I mean, it's an amazing experience as you're walking across, and every 2 seconds you hear somebody else, and you hear the age of like 3, and you hear the age of like 2. And to me, with those things, like, I cannot allow that in my country. I cannot willingly support that in my country. And I have, and for me personally, I have, it's something I have to do. Like, I don't think I could honestly consider myself, I don't know, active in this country. Like, this country's actually mine if I don't take a step in the direction towards what I believe is right and wrong. And I believe what the School of the Americas is doing is definitely wrong. And I'll actually let Borat explain the peace agreements because it's
important. Okay. I first heard about the School of Americas 2 years ago when I got a letter from my sister. I was at a mountaintop village in Italy, and someone brought my mail up to me, and she said that she was going across the line. And I was so excited for her. I wanted to come back and be with her. And then when I decided I was going to be up here for a year, I figured that that was something I wanted to do, that it was important enough for me to do, to try to rally support within the community to do it, and be a representative of the community. So when I went down, before I went, we had a big forum talking about what School of America's was, whether or not this was something that the community wanted to support, and ways that they might do that. And what they decided was that that I would go down representing the community. While I was down there, they would hold a vigil, and they would also send down a bunch of peace cranes that we had made with me, that I would bring with me across the line. And so they made a bunch of peace cranes, and I left. While we were down there, Mary Beth and I wrote the names of everyone in the communities on those cranes. And then when we were all linked up holding arms, we draped the string of peace cranes across our arms and walked across the line together onto the base. For me, that was a powerful time because of the silence and the chanting and the rhythm. I think the more powerful times for me came later in the day. We walked across the line and we were stopped. And one of the powerful moments for me was Saul and I, we were all carrying the crosses, and Saul and I took their 6 crosses and pounded them into the ground in a graveyard that was kind of taking shape along the side of the road. So we pounded our 6 crosses in the ground and then draped the peace cranes across those crosses. And so it felt like I was leaving part of myself there. And then the other powerful moments came later in the day when it wasn't necessarily so clear what was going on with everybody. But people started having great conversations. And I spent a long time in conversation with a group from Xavier that kind of became the hub of a group of what happened was we went across, and then the military kept giving out different things about what they were doing, what was going to happen with people and what wasn't going to happen with people. And everyone else had left earlier as things changed. And so I had taken care of all my bags and blah, blah, blah. and decided that I was going to stay until it was over, which we didn't know when that was going to be, or whether they were saying they were going to process everybody, all 4,000 people or so, or 3,000 that were left at that point, which they were estimating was going to take 3 days to do. But I decided that I was going to stick it out for all that time. And then it became clear they weren't going to process everybody, and they weren't even going to come get everybody. So at that point, it became an issue of whether or not you're just going to stay on the base, potentially overnight, without any food or any shelter or any water. And
And it was hot.
And so I was wearing shorts and a jacket. But it became clear to me that that was what I wanted to do, that I wanted to put myself where it counted, whether you're going to, whether you're going to stand up for what you believe. And that's what I wanted. I was going to do that. So we got to talking, this group from Xavier and I, when, as people were trying to decide what they were going to do, whether they were going to stay or leave or get on the bus. And it was interesting to see, for me, this little group form and have good conversation, and then a good portion of the whole student movement just gathering around that small group. And so it became this movement within the movement, and how those conversations happened and what people's thoughts were and how they worked. For me, it was just a great time to see people figuring out where they stood in this greater problem and how they were going to try to live that out. And those are the conversations and the learning processes and the growth that I experienced that I'll never forget. And then in the end, it turned out that they started, the group kept getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and about 5:45 that night, they started asking people individually whether they were going to stay or leave. And the group, at that point, everyone had pretty much decided that when they were asked by the police, they were going to leave. And so the group kept getting smaller and smaller, and a bunch of people had processed off and had stopped about halfway down the road. And then those of us that had stayed longer until we were asked to leave by the police slowly got up and walked and met them, and then we processed off the base, again chanting the presente.
And Brent had wrote down some of his ideas about thoughts he had before and after. That's, we passed some of those
that's
out.
All before. The letter you have is the letter that I wrote. I was representing the community and also Fullness of God Lutheran Church, which is the church here at Holden. And so that's the letter I sent to all the members, all six members of Fullness of God Lutheran.
It was more than six.
And also that was posted for the community to see. So that's what, that's my reasoning for going down.
I thought this might be just a nice written statement that kind of summarizes a lot of what other people have said about why they got involved. So it'd be something you could take with you. Is there, are there any questions of anyone here that went over the line, or about School of Americas, or about this particular movement or others in general? I mean, one thought I really have is that when the school closes, which maybe will be next year, maybe the year afterwards, you should have a wonderful party, but then not end that, you know, the justice concerns about Central America are over, but have a wonderful party, and then the next day redouble efforts, you know, to identify other areas of injustice and violence to attack, because this is just a good base then to go from. Yes, sir.
Well, I'm sure being an attorney, I'm going to be half facetious. I'm curious, what is the argument for?
Well, there are numerous arguments for, and we really could spend a lot of time on that, but I can summarize them for you. I had a debate in, when was it?
A couple months ago? Early November?
At Gustavus Adolphus College. And the School of the Americas actually sent a lieutenant colonel there, and he had their arguments set forth, and he had a written thing that he read. And so I think their arguments, in summary fashion, are, first of all, this is just a few bad apples. And you can't condemn the whole school. If a few people from Harvard ended up committing some human rights abuses, you wouldn't close that institution.
Which is interesting, though. The reason this is interesting is because in the 60s at Berkeley, there was a radical student movement that blew up a building in LA in an anti-Vietnam protest. And 30 professors and associate professors all were fired. When that happened, that were even if they were just on the mailing list, they were all fired. So that's just something to think about. Like, that's an argument, but in the U.S., like, we won't stand for it.
Another argument that this Lieutenant Colonel Tice made is that if we weren't doing the training, someone else would be doing it, and we're better off to have an American influence to try and promote democracy by having our army be involved. Another argument was that this is being done, this is really not an argument for the School of the Americas, but it was rather a frustration by him. He said, we are training foreign soldiers at many other institutions in our country, and he named a bunch of them. And he said, we are also training in country in 120 different countries around the world, similar trainings, and why are you just picking on the School of the Americas when this is very widespread? And one of the students, it was great back there, he said, well, he raised his hand and says, thanks for telling us about all these other places. No, we didn't know about them before. So I think those were the, and then that they have reformed them. Curriculum is being revised. They've closed the Hall of Fame. They've gotten rid of the torture manuals that were being taught, and that they're doing a better job. And I think the last, and you know, in a way, they really believe in what they're doing. I mean, they aren't being facetious, and it's not all just political. They really think that, you know, by having interaction with these foreign militaries, they make them more professional. If they have contact with America, they will learn that the military has to be subservient to the civil government and process and orderly changes of government and things like that. So they actually believe they're doing something good, and they also believe that a lot of the people that have done things wrong who come out of the School of the Americas, like Noriega and people like that, he even mentioned a few of the names. He said, when those people came, he said, we didn't need to train them in assassination or torture or counterinsurgency. They knew how to do those things better than we could ever train them to do it when they arrived at the School of the Americas. So it was, his perspective was, and the school's perspective is pretty much like that, I think. And of course there's rejoinders to each of the arguments, but. Pete?
What are the chances that they're gonna move all this to another place and do it covertly?
I think very strong. In fact, this was a thing that really bothered me. The general of the Southern Command, who is the head of the whole that whole area, that whole part of the hemisphere, when it became apparent that, you know, they were really losing support in Congress, said that if they close this, you know, we'll open up in Puerto Rico. And it was remarkable to me that he could make that statement publicly and still be claiming that he was teaching democracy at the school, because that would be totally ignoring what the democratic process had done. That is, if you had a majority in Congress, it was going to declare that schools should not exist, just to, you know, have the army unilaterally, because they obviously have that ability and have kept this school quiet for a long time. You know, it's just the consciousness of people has just been awakened.
Oh, I just had a question. I might have missed it. Did you say what the new name of the school is?
Gosh, it's a lot of gobbledygook. It's something like the Cent. It's so long. I think they made it real long just to confuse us, and they've succeeded. It's something like the Center for International Training of Security, something or other. So it's not nearly as easy to say close the SOA, you know, it's close the, be a much longer. But almost every year, politically, they put a lot of time and energy into this, because the day before the protest for the last 3 years, they've come out with a big media blitz. This year they changed the name. Last year they called a debate. You know, they'd never been willing to discuss the issues publicly. So each year they try and do something. This year they had all the kids of the South American officers who were being trained there who were confirmation age to get confirmed.
First communion.
First, oh yeah, took first communion on the day of the protest.
Where?
In Columbus, Georgia. And generated a lot of publicity, and you know, got the pictures in the paper and those sort of things.
Cute little kids in little white dresses.
They have spent a lot of money. They flew a whole contingent down from Minnesota, and a lot of them fairly hand-picked, to tour the School of the Americas and then come out with a statement that indicated the school looked, you know, like a good place to them. So they're engaged in a real strong PR. Yeah, Mark?
Yeah, I'm wondering if there was ever an attempt to convince the president to close it by executive order. Being commander of the armed forces, it seemed like that might even be more effective than pulling their funding, which I have this question in my mind as to, you know, if they have, like, what is the recourse if you take away their funding and they just keep the school going? And, I mean, like, change the name and everything, but is pulling funding necessarily mean the closing school, or if they cut back in other ways and just keep the school going?
I don't know if Clinton would close it. I imagine a lot of people have written him letters and things because, as commander in chief, the army's official position is that it should stay open, and they're trying hard to have it stay open. So I don't think his mind has been changed. As far as the appropriation, you're absolutely right. I mean, or impeachment, they could do it under a different guise, but once that appropriation is gone, they won't have funding for the, you know, classrooms and the teaching at this particular school. So in this form, at least, it would be altered.
Peter, for most of us, we've looked at this school and everything, and we've looked at that in the context of actions committed by foreign military personnel to their own people. Now that the actions are taking place at Fort Benning, would you just say a word about the issue of litigation and the actual charges that are putting someone like Roy Bourgeois, Patty Inman, and others in prison for the length that they are on an open military campus? To me, we've seen the system change again. And it's the same issues of powers and principalities that we're now applying back for our own citizens, those of us who are trying to exercise free speech, walking onto an open campus. And you look at the length of sentences, and you might say a word about the magistrate that's hearing the cases and his history.
Yeah, those are very interesting things. We could talk for a long time. The last comment referred to Judge Robert Elliott, who is the oldest sitting federal judge in the United States. We kind of had the bad luck or good luck, depending on how you'd view it, of getting a very classically austere, pro-military, anti-civil rights judge who was the only one who was in this jurisdiction to hear the cases. It provided me with kind of, since we had such an extreme character, one of the most enjoyable experiences of my legal career, because we tried to get him recused, which is a rare thing in federal court, and we... Recused is getting him kicked off the case. And it's very hard to do because the federal judge passes on that motion himself. So we made the motion. he denied it. We went up and there was evolving law, and the U.S. Supreme Court actually heard the case. So on November 3rd of 93, I got to argue in front of the U.S. Supreme Court for Father Bourgeois and the two other defendants, Pat Litke and Charlie Litke, that the federal recusal laws should be changed. And we lost the case, but we did actually change the laws in some fairly significant way they'd ever served their time. And by the way, like, meeting these people has been such an incredible experience for me. I mean, as I just mentioned, Charlie Littke, I mean, my family has had to listen to all these stories, but I mean, the place of faith that these people come from and their life histories and the things they have done and their unbelievable courage in the face of, you know, not only prison, but all sorts of other dangers, and how they've surrendered so many other things in their life has been such a rich payment and experience for me. It's just unbelievable. But I won't get off on all those stories. As far as the First Amendment, we raised that in one of the cases, and I think it really has some merit, but it's very difficult to fully explore, because the base has set up a rule, and these guys saw it when they went over the line, that no political protesting is allowed. So what our argument was is that the only political protest that has been prohibited is political protest anti-School of the Americas. And that the pro-School of the Americas sentiment and right of expression has been allowed to flourish. And so we called in some local people to testify that they had been on the base and had been to commemorative events or had been asked to speak and things like that. And it's pretty obvious that that was the case, but it was very difficult to establish because there haven't been political protests themselves in terms of marches or those sort of things on the base. And so we wanted to make the point that there has been a choice in terms of content-based discrimination for the enforcement of that regulation. And therefore, if we could show that it was favoring one view over the other, it could be discriminatory and we could get the convictions reversed. We weren't able to make a definite enough showing. I'm sure it's true, but, you know, we couldn't find enough instances where we could show that people were using similar means to speak for the School of the Americas. An interesting little anecdote is there was one pro-School of the Americas person on the reservation this year, and as Martin Sheen walked across the line, he was like in the first line of people. A guy came up, he had a mask over his face, he had a hat over his head, and he threw paint on Martin Sheen, and he screamed at the first six people coming over, "You're all fools and idiots," and then he ran across the base into the woods. Now, of course, none of the MPs stopped him for his trespass, as they did stop all these other people, but that's kind of the things we're really left with. Because, you know, they don't really need to go onto the base to make the point the school should stay open, because
it's on
base. Right. And it's staying open. So, but it's a very good point, and it's kind of a it's somewhat of a frustration that we can't really establish that First Amendment right.
Yeah, I don't think Newt Gingrich was ever arrested for making a half of the school.
Yeah, Gingrich and a lot of other people have been on there.
How do you interpret the Lutheran magazine's article that they put out, which seemed to vindicate this young people that went down and visited, came back and almost whitewashed the place? How do you interpret their willingness to print that when they knew that there was so much opposition to that position?
Well, I would let someone else answer it. I would only, because I didn't see the article, but I have seen other Lutheran magazines at our house talking about congregants who work at Los Alamos and were extolling the virtues of nuclear testing and things like that. So I don't know what the political persuasion of the Lutheran magazine is. Did anyone would like to respond to it who saw it?
The reason that those students were invited to go to the school was that a question was raised at the Peace Prize Forum, which is held by five
the five Norwegian Lutheran schools. A question was raised about the school in America, and so in response to that, the Lieutenant General, I don't know military terminology very well, I haven't had much exposure to it, but that he invited Lutheran students from those five schools to come down. And I'm a student at Luther, one of those five schools, and so I was requested actually to be one of the two people, and I wrote a letter in response, and I kind of kicked myself because I'm not sure it was the best decision, but I wrote a letter in response regarding that I didn't want to go, and I didn't think that anybody from Luther should go because it was on their terms, not ours. It was using military funding to brainwash a perfectly just situation. But two, actually, my closest friends on campus were two of the people who were involved, and I've had a chance to talk to them afterwards. And they've talked about how that Lutheran article wasn't necessarily reflective of their exact views, that they were impressed at some of the things that the military had to offer while they were down there as brothers. But they were impressed more from a PR standpoint than they were from actually being persuaded that the school was really actually existing for a good purpose. But the Lutheran magazine has some great people writing for it, but it doesn't necessarily have a history of real pristine journalism either. So, I wasn't overly impressed with the article, except the friends of mine said that they felt kind of misquoted or misrepresented but I think the Lutheran it's inside the same office as the entire Lutheran church, and it's right downstairs from the bishop's office and so forth. There are political hands just as much.
Well, and I would say, a lot of Ricky and I were on teaching staff here 10 years ago, maybe a little longer, when a lot of the issues about Central America were really being hotly debated, and a lot of people at the village, when there was a presentation made that questioned U.S. foreign policy, were deeply upset with that form of action and criticism of the government. And I remember one gentleman leaving. He got mad and he said, if you don't respect the United States, you're not really a good Lutheran, and he was leaving the place. So, there would be a lot of people that would question what the five of us up here are doing, I'm sure.
In addition, there's a Lutheran chaplain on the base who felt kind of, he'd written a letter regarding how he was somewhat offended by the Lutherans who were involved in the protests because it was kind of an affront to his ministry on that base.
And he's Hispanic, too, so it's complicated by Asian Jews.
And I think, wasn't he partially offended just that they hadn't had any discourse with him first?
Good questions. And it's also hard to get to the truth of the facts right away. What we've been hearing about are a lot of historical things, and just, to bring things up to date a little bit, now, most of the internal conflicts in Latin America are going on in Colombia and are going on in southern Mexico, in Chiapas. And now the human rights reports that are coming in, if I thought I was going to do a presentation, the violations, human rights violations by graduates of the School of the Americas now are coming out of those countries.
And Mexico also has the most students enrolled with School of Americas.
Yeah. Right. All of a sudden it's up because they have, counterinsurgents there. They have communist threats to their society that are coming in. And now, of course, these are the poor people who are asking for unionization and a decent wage, and their standard of living down south is far, far below what it is in the north, particularly since NAFTA has been enacted, and so all of the social problems and foment are going on down there, and as people are starting to disappear and be tortured and all those sort of things, School of the Americas graduates are showing up there too.
Is Roy Bourgeois supported by the Maryknolls?
Very much. He converted them. Hook, line, and sinker. I mean, the head people from Maryknoll have been coming down there to his trials and to the actions now for years. But he was in big trouble there for a while.
He, like, reprimanded him and put him in the corner for a while when he came back from El Salvador.
Do you recall any of the other schools or trainings specifically that you said the military officers said were similar and going on?
Guys, I didn't
read that about one the other day, but I don't remember where it was.
Saul, do you remember what he said? Yeah, there were some other big forts where they're doing training, foreign training.
Fort Leavenworth?
Is Fort Bragg?
Yeah, I think so.
He named off three or four. There is a, it's interesting how people look at it. He was, the day before I went down there, Jack Nelson Palmeyer told me about the INET program, which is where U.S. funds are being appropriated to send people to different countries. And a lot of work's been going on in Indonesia, which of course, the Indonesian soldiers have now just, you know, been guilty of all the human rights abuses on East Timor. And so Lieutenant Colonel Tice was talking about this wonderful IMET program, and Jack Nelson Palmeyer, right, whispering into my other ear, was talking about, tell them about the IMET program, because that's U.S. funds doing the same thing in country all around the world. So, you know, to get the truth out of it and to get the, you know, what really is happening and what trainings are being done is a long process, because the Army is not a transparent operation. It, you know, usually it takes us a few years to get some of the facts. And that's why all this Freedom of Information Act and computerization, for instance, this torture manual, they denied teaching it at the School of Americas for years. We finally got copies of it, and it was the same manuals that had been used in Vietnam that caused My Lai and all those sorts of things, you know, targeting opposition political leaders, targeting university students, targeting religious leaders. And by targeting, they meant, you know, torture, disappearances, assassinations, things like that. It was taught at School of the Americas till 1991. And thousands and thousands of copies were sent home, not only with the graduates, but distributed all throughout South and Central America. And they just basically shrug at that as that, well, it was not, you know, sound policy, but we're not doing that anymore. You can say something about
it. Oh, I read the other day that in Indonesia, it was declared illegal for us to be training troops in 91, I believe. And we've been training troops illegally until 97. I think I read it in Harper's. I'll check it out.
And on INET funds, all INET funds, like, we give out to other countries. And that's how they, like, they're using our funds to train their soldiers. They pick at random whoever they want to send up to the School of the Americas. We have no type of screening process or anything currently. So they're also, they're using, just to even get the people there and back, they're using U.S. funds.
I guess it's just about time for dinner, so if there's any other questions, I'm sure we'd all be happy to answer them individually or collectively. I don't know. thanks for coming, and yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to thank these people for one of the time.